A grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2004-2005 season opens with performances by singer Emmylou Harris, family entertainer Dan Zanes, the Barry Shinkoff Foundation's new theatrical piece, Forbidden Christmas, jazz masters Nancy Wilson and Ramsey Lewis, and sitarist Ravi Shankar. Visit KrannertCenter.com for information on the entire season.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are also pleased to have back here on the program Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She also teaches the med school here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month, always on a Monday, she is here on Focus 580 to talk about women's health. She usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that might be new or in the news, but also she is here to answer your questions. Now, whenever we have physicians on the program, I try to warn people at the beginning of the program that obviously we can't diagnose over the phone. There are some things that the doctor just can't do because she can't see you. However, I don't want to discourage anybody from calling. We do these programs to help you add to your health knowledge, and it might be a place to start. To get some basic information. And, of course, if you have concerns, you need to pursue them with your own doctor or with a doctor who can see you. But questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Good morning.
I know there's some things that you probably would like to talk about. There was one story that I came across, and perhaps people have seen, that I thought certainly it would be a good thing to ask you about. This was a story that was just on the front page of the New York Times just last week, and it's based on a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, where a couple of physicians were looking at national data on pap testing and hysterectomies, and they looked over 10 years, and what they found was that there was as many as 10 million women who had hysterectomies and, I guess this is important,
right,
and no longer had a cervix, who were still getting pap tests. And I think that they're making the argument that there's really, you know, there's no particular reason for them to do that. That's an additional expense, and there's no reason for them to have the test if they don't have a cervix. Now, it is possible that there are women who have had hysterectomies and still do have a cervix. And,
correct.
And I guess for them, you would say, oh, yes. But I guess I wonder what you think about that.
Well, as you know, that the pap smear was invented about 60 years ago, something like that, by Dr. George Papanicolaou, and it's become a nickname for just a screening test for cancer of the cervix, but it actually is technically a test that can be used in a variety of different ways. And obviously, for these women who have had hysterectomies, they aren't getting a cervical pap, they're getting a vaginal pap test.
Hmm.
And there are cells to collect, and you can technically perform that test, and there are specific reasons that some of these women should still have some pap smear testing. But the general principle has probably now been proven well enough in the literature that if you have not had any cervical dysplasia or cancer and are at low risk for ever developing a vaginal cancer and have no symptoms whatsoever, that post-hysterectomy for unrelated reasons, say, for instance, if you had had uterine fibroids or endometriosis or something that was completely unrelated to cervical disease, these women probably can safely abandon actual pap smear testing. Now, again, it starts getting into the concept that some patients will say, I've had a pap test. And what they mean is I've had a pelvic exam. And this study that was talked about in the New York Times was a retrospective study where they talked to patients and said, have you had a pap test? And patients who said yes, they marked them down as yes. And some of these patients may, in fact, have only had a pelvic exam. But we know, based on the way medicine is practiced, that there are probably too many women post-hysterectomy still having pap tests. But we do also want to point out that Worldwide, there are about 450,000 cases of cervical cancer diagnosed each year, and probably 250,000 women die of cervical cancer worldwide each year. And also in the United States, there are about 13,000 cases of cervical cancer diagnosed each year, and 4,000 women die. And the idea behind Pap smear testing is that we would identify pre-invasive disease and get it treated and cured before it becomes invasive cancer. So to that extent, we've fractionated the number of women that are ever diagnosed with cervical cancer. So Pap smear testing of the cervix in general has been wildly successful. And I think the article did talk about the fact that we've done such a good job of tracking and helping to prevent cases of cervical cancer that they think one of the reasons people keep getting pap smears is they're just so enthusiastic about the ability of this test to prevent cancer that they just keep getting their pap tests. So in general, it's important to remember exactly what you said. If you've had a hysterectomy, you should get a consultation with your healthcare provider and say, am I someone who is still at risk for disease that pap smear tests can pick up? And the reason that pap smear tests post hysterectomy can still pick up disease is that the vagina, the lining of the vagina, can undergo some of those same precancerous and cancerous changes as the cervix. And also, in the process of doing a hysterectomy, it is possible to leave microscopic collections of cervical cells. So you want to find out if you were at risk, if you've had your cervix removed. If you still have a cervix, are you still at risk, and do you need pap smears? And we've been talking, and I know in some of the other shows, about some of the newest guidelines regarding pap smears in women with a cervix. And basically, if you are a low-risk person, you have you're over the age of 30, you have a negative HPV test and a negative have had three normal pap smears, you could possibly even go to every 2 to 3 year screening. So even people still having screening tests do not need them as often as other women. And finally, is there a reason you should be getting pelvic examinations that's apart from the pap smear itself? Now, one thing also is most insurance companies tag pap smear testing to the fact that you're female and of a certain age group, and most insurance companies haven't changed the way they reimburse for pap smears post-hysterectomies. I think that will change. We know that Medicare, for instance, only pays for screening pap smears every 2 years if there's no other indication for it. So I think that will also change. And also, the article, I think, also talked about, I read the actual original study and the author's conclusions. I'm not sure if it went into this in the New York Times, but they talked about the fact that internally, some doctors groups have performance measures they have to live up to. So, for instance, their office may track the numbers of patients they had and the numbers of pap smears those patients had performed. And they maybe weren't being separated out in performance measures by whether the patient had had a hysterectomy or not. So I think that as we get to a more rational policy for patients post-hysterectomy, we will see the numbers of pap smears radically decline on hysterectomy patients.
Hmm. One of the things I was wondering about is when you're making the decision to have that surgery or to perform that surgery, how do you decide whether or not you're going to leave the cervix?
Well, to some extent, it was very popular to leave the cervix years and years and years ago. And then we had an epidemic of abnormal pap smears, and we still were seeing a number of cervical cancers, but we were seeing a lot of precancer of the cervix, which we still have an epidemic of precancer of the cervix, and I could get back to talking about that in a second. But because of that, the recommendations in the 70s and 80s and early 90s was pretty much always take the cervix if you're having a hysterectomy and removing the rest of the uterus. But there began to be some literature out of Europe regarding sexual function post-hysterectomy, and maybe leaving the cervix would enable you to have better sex post-hysterectomy. Also, we do have women who have prolapse of the vagina or dropping of the tissues of the vagina after hysterectomies. And it was thought that if you leave the cervix, you're less likely to have to cut through or disrupt any of the supporting structures of the pelvic floor, which is like a giant sling, essentially. And by doing that, they thought that women would have less problems with bladder and incontinence and things like that post-hysterectomy if you just leave the cervix and just take the top part of the uterus. We also began to develop certain techniques to be able to leave the cervix and still have laparoscopic type surgeries. So it became popular again in the mid to late 90s to leave the cervix more often. But probably, I would say, of women getting hysterectomies in the United States today, and this is just a pure guess, I haven't read a recent article about it, I would probably say only maybe 1% to 2%, maybe as high as 5%, but I don't think so, have their cervix left after a hysterectomy. So almost no one. And it is important to know what your surgery was. And you know, I do a lot of research studies. I talk about a lot of them. And I was doing one research study recently that was simply a survey study. But of the patients that were entered into the survey study, we needed to know whether they had ovaries or they didn't have ovaries and whether they had a uterus or they didn't have a uterus. And this study required me to, quote unquote, prove it. And that meant, ideally, I would have a copy of the operative report and the pathology report. And so I was calling many, like other communities. We have people that had their surgeries in other communities. And I was calling big cities around our community to try to get pathology reports and operative notes that were more than 10 years old. And I discovered it was hard to get. I couldn't obtain these pieces of information on all of my patients that I needed to, so couldn't enter some of these patients in the study. And it was really unfortunate, and it reminded, now that we're talking about it, it was something that I did want to bring up and tell patients that, you know, it's not a bad thing to at least keep a copy of your op note and a copy of your pathology report for yourself, because doctors aren't required, nor are hospitals required, to keep records permanently. And sometimes you may not have access to those pieces of information.
Okay. Well,
kind of interesting.
Our guest this morning is part of Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on the program once a month. It's always a Monday, and we talk about women's health. So questions are welcome. Could be on this or just about anything else that has to do with her area of practice. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455.
This is an area of medicine where we've really been talking a lot, and I think I've also mentioned this before on previous shows, about how it's not only the fact that we've done a good job of getting the word out that you need to get your pap smears, and it's very true that for patients who undergo pap smear screening, their chance of ever getting cervical cancer is relatively extremely low. And many of the cases that we do diagnose in the United States were people who never did get a recent pap smear. But it's also very important to then do the follow-up testing. And when a patient gets an abnormal pap smear, she often will need a follow-up test or a biopsy to determine if there's something really wrong or if it's just inflammation or infection or perhaps her hormonal status. And that follow-up test is usually called colposcopy. And then once we do a biopsy and we determine if there are precancerous changes, then the common method of curing those precancerous changes has been to remove parts of the cervix. And those removal operations could be done with a laser. Or in the past, they were often done with cryosurgery, which is a freezing. And nowadays, we do a procedure called a LEAP, which is a nickname for large loop excision procedure, and it's done with essentially a small electrified wire, and a portion of the cervix, which contains the abnormal cells, is actually physically removed. And we do a good job of curing dysplasia with this, but we do a bad job of a couple of things. Number one, we've done more and more of these procedures on very young people. teenagers even, and people in their early 20s prior to childbearing. And we are now very concerned that too many of these LEAP procedures done on very young people might hamper their chances of successfully achieving or continuing pregnancies. So the current thinking is to delay some pap smears. In other words, we don't necessarily need to diagnose these conditions in the very, very young because so many do spontaneously resolve. Also, to observe more than just immediately operate. So rather than immediately take someone to one of those surgeries after her abnormal pap smear, perhaps follow her over the course of 6 months or even a year in some cases before recommending surgery. And then, of course, lastly, which is my favorite solution, is to try to prevent these diseases altogether. And to that end, we've been working on vaccine studies. And I think I talked about a vaccine study that we were involved with that was done on much younger patients in the 16 to 23 age to try to prevent picking up the human papillomavirus, which we think is the actual cause of most of the cervical cancers that develop. And we're currently involved in recruiting healthy patients in the 24 to 45 age group that will be treated with the same vaccine. And I think in the last show, I was talking about a press release from another company that is working on a similar type of vaccine that doesn't target as many of the HPV types as some of the vaccines that have been tested, like the one we tested in the younger age group. But that seems to be the thinking is to prevent many of these abnormal pap smears so that some of these issues, like getting too many pap smears and so forth, will start to go away as we change the whole spectrum of the disease and make it much more rare.
Okay. Well, again, people have questions, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is our monthly visit with Dr. Trupin, and whatever's on your mind, as long as it fits within the topic, women's health, you can give us a call. Well, usually you come and have a couple things that you want to be talking about. What's on your list?
Well, there's still quite a bit out there on hormone replacement therapy, and I think there will be for a long time because it's become such a controversial subject. And no matter where I go and what group of ladies I end up talking to, whether it's a patient or friends or neighbors, it seems like people have a lot of questions on hormone replacement therapy, and people will always walk up to me and say things like, should my mom take hormones or something like that? And I still like to think of a question like that as, you know, what should my sixth move in the chess game be? I mean, you kind of have to know what the first five moves are. And we talk a lot about that, kind of targeting different individuals and what they need. And it's really so controversial still. I mean, our goal is to live as healthy and happy and with our wits about us as long as we possibly can. And there's still a lot of evidence out there that as women move through the perimenopause, the time right before menopause, into menopause, which the official definition of menopause is 1 year with no period, and into postmenopause, what each individual person needs in that stretch really highly varies. So that in the perimenopausal time is mostly when people start experiencing irregular periods and the beginnings of hot flashes, but that is the time when people experience the biggest complaints in terms of their sleep. And I start hearing a lot of complaints about weight gain. And of course, we have a problem with weight gain in our population in general. And there was just a new estrogen and weight gain study. It was done in mice. And my patients are always saying, when are you going to start a study on weight gain? And we always look at it with all the studies that we're doing, but so far I haven't actually found a compound or a study to be involved with that I've really felt was the right answer. But it was interesting. Some researchers were trying to blame the weight gain at the time of menopause on thyroid dysfunction, and we do find find women with more thyroid dysfunction at this time, but they still think that somehow estrogen modulates both the amount you eat, the type of food you eat, the amount of weight you put on, and where you put on that weight. So it's pretty fascinating that they think that estrogen may still be beneficial. And I think I talked about some of these studies literally years and years ago that they said that some women who take hormones in menopause maintain a better waist-to-hip ratio. So they stay like pears, smaller waist relative to bigger bottoms, hips, and so forth, as opposed to the apple configuration where you have a big waist and thinner legs. And we think that that pear configuration actually is better in terms of heart disease. And so they were starting to try to prove all this in mice, a little bit difficult, but specifically they were looking at various types of estrogens, even selective estrogen receptor modulator type compounds, the designer type estrogens, and they were finding that of the mice that were treated with estrogen, actually they were the skinnier mice. So we'll see about that. So don't blame all your weight gain on just estrogen. Also, there was another article about hormone replacement therapy and heart disease, and specifically looking at transdermal hormone therapy. In other words, the patches. And there was some evidence that the patches do not control the homocysteine level as well. And that's a metabolism of folate, one of the B vitamins. And this study was specifically saying that patch users may not, in fact, be as successful at preventing heart disease as younger women who are tried on estrogen. So this whole heart disease and hormone therapy topic is still just wide open. But still, when I answer specific questions about hormones, I pretty much tell patients that it would be important to reduce your risk of heart disease by lowering your weight and increasing your exercise and reducing smoking. And what we use hormone therapy for is to improve your sexuality, to improve your sleep, to reduce your hot flashes, to reduce vaginal dryness, to improve some of the consequences of vaginal dryness, like urinary complaints. And those kinds of things are still very well treated by hormones. And what we're trying to understand is what type of hormone is the best, what dose is the best, what combination is the best. Is the best combination with a progesterone? And if so, would it be a natural progesterone? Is the best combination with a testosterone? Or are you somebody that can be handled by estrogen alone? So we're involved with one study that is specifically looking at patients who aren't satisfied with their current hormone therapy and not getting relief of all the things they're supposed to with taking their hormone therapy, and looking at a different type of estrogen and whether estrogen alone or estrogen and male hormone combinations are going to be the right type of therapy.
Let me ask you a basic question. Again, we've talked about this so many times about menopause. The average, if I'm remembering now, the average age for menopause is 51 and a half?
Yeah. Right? I always say 51.4.
Okay. Slightly under that. Okay. And menopause is defined as 1 year, no periods.
Correct.
Right. Okay. The period of the perimenopause, that is the period that comes before that, where you may see experience some of the same signs, as you say, you get beginnings of hot flashes, you may be having sleep problems, you may be having irregular periods and stuff like that. How long a period of time is that?
Well, there was a new study where a bunch of experts got together and they came up with what they call the straw classification, trying to define that period of time. And they had a 2 year period lead in and a 1 year period before that with lesser symptoms. But some studies show that in some women, that period of time can actually be as long as 6 to 8 years. But for most people, a couple of years.
Is there some benefit? And now I guess there's also sort of an issue. We talked about this before too, to have a firm diagnosis, if that's the right word to use, to find out whether a woman is in perimenopause, what you'd have to do is you'd have to do some tests. You'd have to check hormone levels. It would be a lot of trouble. It would be expensive. So apparently nobody ever really does that. But is there, if you had, we're pretty sure that you were into perimenopause, and if you were at the right time age-wise, is there some benefit, or, I mean, when would you say that if you at least wanted to talk about your doctor about the possibility of hormone replacement, when you would want to have that conversation?
Well, I think that you bring up a really good point, and that's exactly one of the current dilemmas that some obstetrician gynecologists and some primary care doctors find themselves in. Because 5 years ago, we really believed that hormone replacement therapy would help prevent cardiovascular disease. And we also believed, which we know it still does, it would protect your bones. It could, there was evidence that it could protect you against Alzheimer's. There's evidence that it could help protect you against macular degeneration of the eye. There was evidence that it could help actually improve your teeth. There's evidence, which there still is, that it would reduce colon cancer. So our thinking was that virtually everybody would benefit from hormone replacement therapy. So doctors started to suggest the idea in the early 40s and start questioning their patients about any change in their menstrual cycle. And boom, as soon as there were some signs and symptoms that there would be a change, there was a good starting point to discuss that conversation. Well, now with the current thinking being what it is, basically the current thinking amongst a certain group of experts, and now the experts seem fairly well split into the sort of the hangover estrogen evangelists and the others, and the most of the current thinking is now if you really are having no actual symptoms and no actual active problems, then you don't really need to have a discussion about hormone replacement therapy. But if you're having any menopausal symptoms, if you're having decreased sex drive, if you're having a change in your menstrual cycles, then you should do both of those things you were talking about. One, get an accurate diagnosis. Is this perimenopause or something else going on? And two, what else would I rationally do about it? And then, of course, we've got the whole group of patients between the ages of their late 40s and their early 70s who are still on hormone replacement therapy, either because of indications or because just their physician had started them on it with the belief that they were going to do better than nature. They weren't trying to be natural, trying to do better than nature. And that group now has to have the discussion, do I really still need it? And if so, what type, what dose, and for how long? And what are my alternatives? There are a lot of alternatives. There are alternatives for treating sleep disorders. There are alternatives for treating vaginal dryness. There are alternatives for treating the bladder. There are alternatives for treating the bone. So you kind of need an evaluation.
Hmm. Well, just to round this out, and then we have a caller we'll get right to. It could be, I could imagine, a lot of women who are approaching menopause, who had heard the recent news about the studies showing there could be a lot of problems associated with hormonal replacement. I want to say, well, I don't want to have anything to do with this. Is there, and again, I know you've always been very careful to say this is a decision that has to be tailored individually to a particular woman.
Sure.
So you got to sit down, you've got to get medical history, and you've got to talk about, okay, what is it we're trying to do here? There's no one-size-fits-all approach. But having said that, I mean, would you still make the argument that for some women, some period of hormonal replacement, perhaps, you know, a year's worth, 2 years' worth, something like that, might have benefits, and the potential risks would be small enough so that the potential benefit would outweigh the risk?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the literature supports that. And when they say short term, they start saying less than 5 years. But we now are approaching to some extent that slippery slope that, okay, now we're getting into our fourth and fifth year. And maybe the patient is just now, maybe she started that in her late 40s. And maybe she's just now reaching the natural age of menopause, and trying to get her off the hormone therapy is just going to cause a resurgence of some of those same symptoms. And so 5 years of short-term use doesn't even seem rational for some patients. But the other side is that when we talked about heart prevention, we were talking about people in their late 40s, early 50s, starting on hormone therapy. And when Women's Health Initiative talked about heart harm, they took women in their late 50s, early 60s, and tried to reverse pre-existing heart disease. Well, that wasn't primary prevention. So we're still left with a little bit of a gap in terms of really knowing all the facts that are going to eventually factor into those individual discussions. But there's no doubt about it. If there's somebody that is not having any hot flashes and everybody in her family lives for a long time and she has no bone disease and she has no problem with her sexuality and so forth and so on, she doesn't need hormones. She probably doesn't even need to discuss it. But for women who are starting to have what we kind of have termed the menopausal syndrome, and that is some of the side effects I was talking about, then she should at least discuss the potential risk benefits. And I think that there are actually many women that will still find that there is a important risk-benefit ratio to trying the hormone therapy for short periods of time.
Okay. We have a call here in Charleston. Let's talk with them. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a couple questions about bladder infections. And I know that with increased sexual activity, new partners, the odds on getting a bladder infection are pretty good. Is there anything that you can do preventatively? I mean, other than drinking a lot of water, staying clean, urinating after sex, any of those sorts of things that you can, that would help reduce the incidence of bladder infections?
Well, all of the things you say are perfectly good solutions to reducing your chance of getting bladder infections. For people who get recurrent bladder infections, usually that is not enough. And someone who's had several infections, and we usually say three or more within 1 year, she might actually be a candidate to taking a very low dose of an antibiotic. Usually we use the kinds of antibiotics we call broad spectrum, so they would hit a lot of different types of bacteria that you could pick up, and usually the types that are kind of old-fashioned antibiotics, and they're not usually very expensive, and you just take one each night after intercourse, and that helps to prevent infections. Doesn't prevent them completely, but it does help to prevent. And the other thing is that in cranberries and in blueberries, there are substances that help us fight off bacterial infections. And you can either drink cranberry juice or blueberry juice, or now they have cranberry pills and blueberry pills. So whatever you can get a hold of in your local grocery store or pharmacy or natural health food store, those all actually work as well. And the final piece is whether or not you should have sex with condoms. Of course, condoms are a very important solution to preventing certain types of sexually transmitted diseases and helping to prevent other types of infections. We unfortunately know that condoms really don't pretty much do anything to prevent picking up human papillomavirus, which is not a virus that can cause a bladder infection, but it's always important when talking about condoms to kind of put them in perspective. And yet women who have sex with condoms, either the male condom or the female condom, but of course more couples are using male-type condoms, they are more prone to getting infections.
Really? I didn't know that.
Unfortunately, it's true.
Okay. You mentioned the low-dose antibiotics, which you would just take after sex each time. Do those have side effects of, like, causing diarrhea? I mean,
well, like any antibiotic, some people can have side effects like that. But ideally, you would get something low enough dose that you yourself tolerate. There are a few different ones that we use. And in the United States, none of them are over-the-counter, although they are in some countries. But it'd have to be something that you have to get a prescription from your health care provider for.
Okay, and those you would just take, like, after sex? You wouldn't be taking it every single day?
Well, if you have sex every day, you would be taking it every single day. But most people just take it on the days that they have intercourse. And what the other thing is that do you have to do this the rest of your life? I do have patients that have done this for literally decades, but it may be something where you could do it for a few years, and then if you weren't getting infections, try to discontinue that. The other thing is what you use for lubricants, and saliva is a lot higher count in bacteria than just things like KY jelly or slippery stuff. There's about 15 different brands out there of lubricants for intercourse, and actually that probably reduces your chance of infection more than just using saliva.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troupin. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. She also teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign once a month, always on Monday she's here. We talk about women's health, and your questions are welcome. Just for a second, I want to go back to the hormonal replacement and the menopause question. I'm wondering if, say you have a woman who is, let us say, a woman who is 50. And is pretty confident that she's in the perimenopause and getting close to menopause, and she makes this decision to go on to hormonal replacement. So if we say that, she's going to be on short term, she starts when she's about 50. So here now at about 55, say five
Correct.
Years later, we say, okay, now's the time to stop. When she stops, what happens? Is she going to start to experience some of the same stuff that she would have 5 years earlier if she didn't start taking the hormones?
Well, remember, the results from the Women's Health Initiative have just been trickling in over the past couple of years. And so we have not seen large groups of patients that we have tried to remove off hormone replacement therapy until very recent times. Mm-hmm. It seems that based on a few small studies that have been done and a lot of clinical experience by gynecologists who prescribe hormone replacement therapy, that older patients in their 70s, have really no trouble stopping their hormones. Patients in their 60s don't typically have a lot of difficulty stopping their hormone therapy, but patients in their mid-50s often will have a resurgence of their symptoms and require a lot of careful management. So the current thinking is, number one, perhaps treat with the lowest effective dose. So don't always get all your patients up to these high doses of hormones that we used to use, and that'll be easier. Secondly, wean a lot more slowly. And thirdly, it's still important for patients who get to this point and feel they still do need the therapy to understand that even though these studies showed that the risks were greater than what we thought, the risks are still small. So that when they talked about, say, heart attacks, they had 30 out of 10,000 women in one group and only 37 out of 10,000 in the group using hormones. So we're only talking 7 extra women out of 10,000. So it's important to remember that the risks are still small.
Okay. I think we have the caller from Charleston who maybe wanted to follow up.
Oh, okay.
Up.
Sorry.
We'll go back to her real quick here in line two. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
How does one know whether or not you can still get pregnant if you're at menopausal age, you're still having periods, but you may not be ovulating, right? I mean, so
Correct.
What kind of birth control is recommended?
Well, that's a really good question. Spontaneous pregnancy after the age of 46 is pretty rare, so that the kinds of birth control do not have to be as effective, so that spermicides and condoms, that sort of thing, are very effective in that age group. We also have to remember, in the United States, about 1/3 of people are already sterile by that age, either because their husband's had a vasectomy or their partner, or they themselves have had tubal ligation. Now we have this new method of sterilization, the E-Sure, where little coils are inserted in an office setting under local anesthesia. It's great. I really think it's going to really catch on, so it'll probably be even higher percentage. There are studies that can be done to see if you're still ovulating, but also in the late 40s, many women start having irregular periods and can be very well controlled in terms of their irregular bleeding by hormone birth control pills. So even though they may not necessarily need that much contraceptive protection, the birth control pills can do other things, help control bleeding from fibroids. And we know that about 1/3 of women in their late 40s have fibroids. So it's probably best, done as individual consultation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Let's go back to, Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I had a question about yeast infections, and I know that if you can prevent them by wearing cotton underwear and things like that, but I wondered if you had any more insight.
Well, actually, the cotton underwear thing hasn't been shown in research to work, but I still tell patients that, and it's in every article and every glamour magazine where they're, you know, those types of women's magazines that write up yeast infections. We think that about 1 in 4 women carries the yeast organisms around, and that it's things that get your system out of balance. So if you change your pH, our pH is supposed to be very acidic, and frequent intercourse can actually slightly reduce the pH. If something's gone wrong with your immune system, like you're a diabetic or something's different about your immune system, that you're pregnant, things like that can increase your chance of getting a yeast infection. A little bit more common with condoms, a little bit more common if you have frequent partners, but most likely in most patients, the secret to controlling the infection is getting it properly diagnosed and properly treated and treated until it's eradicated. And some of the over-the-counter medicines don't cover all the yeast organism as well as things that you can get by prescription, so that if you've self-treated a couple of times, some of the things that you can do is get into the doctor, really make sure that the infection that you were self-treating is gone. And that will probably do more than all the other home remedies, eating yogurt and even using plain yogurt vaginally and a lot of the other kinds of recommendations, avoiding douching, things like that, really in most of the studies haven't really been shown to work very well.
All right, to Southern Illinois. This is our next caller on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Do you know of any studies that have been done on natural hormone replacement therapy, like by a compounding pharmacist with wild yam?
Well, there have been a few studies, but not a lot. Wild yam is contains a substance that can be in the laboratory processed to a type of progesterone, and it's usually the natural hormones that are compounded for estrogen usually start with soy-based or compounds like that. And most studies of hormone therapy talk about their effectiveness and their effectiveness relative to the amount of hormone that you are taking or being given. And some of the compounded medications can be formulated to mimic what is available, but some of them are fine-tuned to a degree that's not been shown in traditional research to make much difference.
I'm using it for hot flashes, and it's been really effective. And I was just wondering why it has to, well, I guess it has to be compounded for each person's physical need. But I was also wondering, when you go through menopause, I know a lot of friends that have had thyroid problems. Do you address that when a person is going through, if they have a hypothyroid, that can cause more extreme menopause problems?
Well, hypothyroidism, which means an inactive thyroid gland, is relatively easily diagnosed by blood testing. And with the available thyroid medications as supplements, it's relatively easy to control and keep a person's level within what we consider a normal physiologic range. So of the patients who have, number one, been diagnosed, number two, have achieved a certain stability on their thyroid medicine, we don't think that, in fact, that should affect their menopause too much. It is, number one, possible to not have been diagnosed yet. So it's important for women as they age to get some sort of systematic screening. It's also important if you are having symptoms that can be symptoms of low thyroid, even if they mimic the symptoms of menopause, to be sure and get your thyroid screened. And so certainly treating with hormone therapy when you've misdiagnosed and you should be treating with thyroid hormone therapy, it's a big difference there. So that's important. And also any additional medicines that you take can throw off the dose and the control from any other medicine. So it's important to get your thyroid levels checked as you become menopausal and start on hormone therapy. And that way, any individual woman could keep under better control.
What do you recommend for the thyroid? Is it the free T3 and T4 to be checked, or is there other?
Our thyroid gland makes a hormone called thyroxine, mm-hmm. and it usually circulates in the blood as a certain chemical form called T4, but T3 is a little bit more active. So if you were actually going to measure the amount of thyroid circulating in your blood, we usually do measure T3s and T4s. For anyone who is getting screened for thyroid disease, we think that the most sensitive, easy, quick, inexpensive, accurate screening test is something called a TSH, and that stands for thyroid stimulating hormone, and it's a pituitary hormone that is secreted in response to whatever the thyroid gland is producing. So that if our thyroid gland is producing a normal amount of thyroid hormone, the TSH level will be normal. If our thyroid is overproducing thyroxine, then the TSH level is very, very low. So that would be a signal for hyperthyroid. And if our thyroid gland is not producing enough hormone at all, then the TSH level rises. So it would be greater than you would expect. So that first screening test is usually done with a TSH. And then if you've been diagnosed or you're being maintained on thyroid hormone, we do use these other measures along with some other very sophisticated measurements of thyroid function to follow and see if the therapy is adequate.
What do you think about the basal temperature that people take in the morning? To see if their temperature is below normal every morning before rising.
Meaning for control of their thyroid disease?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It can be important if you're still not being adequately controlled or you have a difficult case or you're having symptoms, but it's usually not a first-line recommended therapy or it's not something that most general, say, primary care physicians or primary care gynecologists would probably recommend that you follow. But occasionally endocrinologists do use that test.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have about maybe 2-3 minutes left in this part of Focus with Dr. Suzanne Troopman. Somebody wants to call real quick, we can get him in. Otherwise, are there some other things that you wanted to mention?
Yes, there was an interesting report about vegetarians and pregnancy. It was kind of a very strange report. We've talked before about alpha-fetoprotein test screening, and it's a marker for certain types of birth defects, but some pregnant moms will have abnormal tests where there's actually nothing that we've determined that is abnormal about the pregnancy. And it turns out that some vegetarians are very low in vitamin B12 levels, which we know because that is one of the vitamins that you can get from eating meat. And if you're not careful to plan your diet, you can run into minor deficiencies. And they were seeing that some vegetarians had abnormally high percentage of these false positives on this alpha-fetoprotein test screening for Down's patients, and they linked it to low B12, so it was kind of interesting. So it just gives us one more insight as to, you know, what could possibly be wrong if the test was abnormal, but we haven't determined that there's anything wrong with the pregnancy.
Try to get one more caller here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question. That what causes that some women get menopause at 40?
Well, there are certain genetic heritages that go through menopause early. It's also possible to get viral infections that cause premature menopause. Of course, in the United States, removing the ovaries or having prior ovarian surgery is also a common cause of premature menopause. And those are the most common types. We find that women who undergo, we call it POF, premature ovarian failure, actually about 1/4 of those patients will go back into regular cycling even after being diagnosed. So it may be not accurately diagnosed. They were thought that they were completely in menopause, but they just had a transient low production of hormone and they really hadn't completely crossed through. And that's probably more common.
The only thing that I know about the person that I'm talking, just she didn't get her that monthly period from 40.
Yeah. Well, it can happen, and she certainly is somebody that can undergo blood hormonal testing to determine if that is what, in fact, is going on. And she'd also be somebody that would be at risk for premature bone thinning and premature heart disease. So she would benefit by talking to her healthcare provider about what she can do to prevent some of those consequences as she ages.
And when you said viral infection, means what?
Fevers. And, of course, chemotherapies. There are other causes, but it can happen.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Well, we will have to leave it for this time around, with promise set again next month. Dr. Troopman will be back. We'll do it again. Suzanne Troopman is an obstetrician gynecologist. She also teaches U of I Med School here at Urbana-Champaign. Once a month, she's here on the program to talk about women's health. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our program, Focus 580, in fact, all of our program, is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. We are now just 3 days away from the end of our fiscal year, and all of the money that will pay for next year's programming has to be in the bank by that point. If we're going to maintain all the programs that you value, we need to close the gap that remains by June 30th. And right at the moment, we are just a little over $80,000 short of our listener support goal. But you can help us meet that goal right now by giving us a call. The number, not the number for the show, but our other number is 217-244-9455. You can call and make a pledge with your credit card. If you're online, go to our website, will.uiuc.edu. And again, you can use your credit card to make a contribution on our webpage. You can also send us a check. If you get it in the mail right away, please mail that to UIF. WILL Radio, 300 North Goodwin Avenue in Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Or maybe the easiest thing to do would be just give us a call. Again, it's 217-244-9455. Your support is greatly appreciated. In the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the provisions of the new Medicare prescription drug legislation that went into effect last year. People still seem to find it very confusing, so we'll try to straighten things out as we talk with Mary Agnes Carey from Congressional Court. First, though, we are going to take a break. We'll have news at a minute past the hour, and before that, an update on the markets.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
And coming up on 10:59 with this update on the markets, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. A lot of red on the screen. The wheat contract for July is down 4.25 now, 3.37 even. September wheat down 4.5 at 3.45.5. July corn down 5.25 at 2.71. September down 5.75 at 2.74.75. December down 7 at 2.78.5, and March 05 corn down 6.25 at 2.84.75. Over in the soybean pit, July soybeans 8.87, the current quote, that's down 35.5.